Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society on Penny Isler. As Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter your age, your abilities, or inabilities. Later in the service, we'll ask visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourself so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community like today, or by our minister, Sandra Ingham. This morning's opening words, yes, will be delivered by Karen Deaton. There she is.
For years now, my conservative friends have asked me, do you really want to live in a welfare state? I've thought about it and I've decided, yes, I do. I do want to live in a welfare state. If we define welfare in the original meaning of the word, the condition of being or getting along well, to fare well, welfare, then yes, I do want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that my well-being and the well-being of everyone else means that all have healthy food, clean water, clean air, proper housing, an affordable, if not totally free, education, and full access to complete health care throughout our lives, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that we take care of the earth and the destructive practices that are poisoning the planet we are blessed to share, and begin to implement policies and practices that support and sustain our lives and the lives of generations to come, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that people and not corporations and corporate profits are the primary concern of our politicians and our national and international policies, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that the rights of all people to live in safety are protected by sensible laws that protect the citizens and children against violence and those who would place personal freedom over the good of all people, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that all people, regardless of their color, spiritual or ethical beliefs, gender, sexual orientation, or political views, are afforded the same rights and privileges as everyone else, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that all people, without exception, are given the right to vote without fear of harm, reprisal, or discrimination, and that money plays no part in whether a person can run for and hold office, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our justice system does not favor corporations or one part of society over any other, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our prison system is one that is run not by for-profit corporations, that its purpose is restorative and not retributive or punitive, and one that sees the humanity in all people, difficult as that may be at times, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means having an economic system that is not exploitative of workers and does not perpetuate an oppressive class system, one that ensures that all people have the dignity of work and a fair and livable wage, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our system of taxation is fair, progressive, and free of loopholes that favor the wealthy and corporations over all others, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that each of us care for the other, that the least among you is cared for and loved as much as everyone else, that racism, sexism, ageism, and all negative and harmful isms become a thing of the past, that we all support each other in living our lives to their fullest potential, and that we are all faring well, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. In fact, I want to live in a welfare world. Mm-hmm. And that was written by Paul Stefan Dotenhoff.
At this time, we welcome Ron Fye and Barb Chatterton to light our chalice.
Let there be light. Let it shine in dark places, in moments of pain, in moments of grief, in the darkness of hatred, violence, oppression, where there is discouragement and despair. Wherever darkness is to be put into a flight, let there be light.
At this time, ask Pam Gates to hobble up here and give an introduction. Pam is on our Social Concerns Committee, and I know exactly how you feel.
Okay, one of the advantages of being Prairie's Moses representative is that I get to meet really cool people, like our guests today. John Mix is one of the five co-founders of Moses. Which happened, I believe, in 2011. He was a full-time chaplain at the Dane County Jail from 2007 to 2015. And he painted at least one of the portraits in this exhibit, this traveling exhibit, and has been a painter and sculptor for 30 years. Rudy Bankston, our other speaker, is an author who has published several books, which are on the back table. He will be happy to autograph a copy for you and sell it to you. I personally recommend Snippets of Soul, which I bought, some time back. It's a book of haiku, and they're really very good. Rudy is an employee of Madison's Public Schools. He's a restorative justice coach for the school district, and has some employment at Edgewood College as well, or Edgewood. I want to end my introduction with the last sentence of Rudy's introduction to this book. He hopes the reader, quote, catches a compelling glimpse of the buried humanity inside America's injustice system. So I introduce to you John Mick and Rudy Bankston.
Thanks so much for the invitation to come and share with you this morning. I recall some years ago, I came when I was still a chaplain at the county jail and shared a message with you. I just wanted to give a few comments about the paintings, and then Rudy is going to share the most of this time that we have. I think it's most important that we get a word from him, given his experience. On Monday night, about 8 to 10 of us here in Madison gather at a studio, a painting studio on the east side, Winnebago Studios. Unfortunately, now this month actually is going to be torn down. It's been good years there, but they're going to build a co-housing project on that property, and so. But anyway, we've been meeting there for years, and we decided that we would like to invite people who have been incarcerated in the past. They've survived and they're back in the community, putting their lives back together and contributing in all kinds of ways. So we invited them to come and sit for us. And this is just a few paintings of the 50 that were shown last summer at Overture Center. And the title was, as you've seen, if you've read some of this, Faces of Incarceration, Changing the Narrative. So that our goal as artists was to number one, lift up their humanity and amplify their dignity and beauty, and we're so thankful that they're here among us and back, in many cases back to where they've had their previous lives. And but also secondarily, the purpose of the show was to continue to raise the questions that their stories raise. Namely, we are living in a country where mass incarceration is standard. That's just assumed in most states in in the United States. So we object to that policy and know that gross and ugly injustices are done in our names. And so particularly in Wisconsin, and the racial disparities in Wisconsin are the worst in the country. No other state incarcerates per percentage of the population as many African Americans as Wisconsin does. If you'd asked me that question some years ago, I would have said, well, probably Mississippi or Alabama is probably the state that does. No, Wisconsin. So we just recently saw a defeat of a bill, and this is why Moses is part of my ongoing agenda. There was a bill that was proposing to build another prison in Wisconsin. And fortunately, it went down. It's not going to happen. But we are going to be vigilant that if that ever comes up again. So that brings it to where perhaps I want you to consider where your contributions can be, that your participation in Moses and other ways as a citizen, expressing your indignance and your commitment to peace and justice. So, Rudy, I'd love it if you could just share the rest with us, okay? And there'll be room for conversation or discussion afterwards.
All right, just to be clear, what time do we end? I got issues with time.
I can't see the clock. Till 11.
All right, can somebody give me the Black Panther sign when it's almost that time? Because I lose it. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me. I'm still kind of dwelling on the children's story. There might be lobsters. And that's the beginning of a poem right there. And definitely the beginning of a haiku. I already counted the first five syllables in that. So, but that talks a lot to how we've been conditioned to fear, and how fear is quite often, I think it's our most creative, the most creative thing we have, because we can create a fear in our head and it becomes so vivid, we're absolutely convinced that it's real. And it's a lot of fear about men who are incarcerated, even though they're clearly our brothers and our sisters. It's important for me to say sisters, because women are getting locked up at an alarming rate today. So just to acknowledge that and speak that in the room is important. And also, I got to say that the choir sounded wonderful. So y'all filled my heart this morning with y'all's song, and I appreciate that. But I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the youngest of four. I went through the school system there, and I say the school system, I need to start at the school system, because when we talk about the school to prison pipeline, school is quite often the beginning of that, when young people begin to feel disconnected and young people are underserved. And in Madison, thank God, we're really trying to shift the conversation away from this deficit thinking of young people and really look at it more through an asset-based lens, where young people come to school with stuff. And I've never met a young person who did not want to learn, but it's a matter of how they learn and if they feel comfortable learning. And that needs to start at a relationship, because relationship is the on-ramp of learning. And a lot of the work that I do in the school district is based around relationship and really honoring the innate worth of every individual, and also honoring our connection. But in school, I did not have that. In fact, when I was 13 or 14 years old, I was kicked out of school. Maybe it was a wooded area in our middle school. And down the street from it, me and a group of guys, we were in there playing with a fake gun. And it's not the BB guns that we see today that are real, just a fake starter gun. And we were in this just wooded area people used to hang out in. It was not on the school grounds, But the next day, the police showed up, took me to the detention center. I told them where the gun was. They got it, saw that it was fake, and I was still charged as if it was a real gun. I was expelled from school and put in an alternative school program. And I'm one of the youngest people in that program. And my peer group soon consist of guys who had been through the system as well. This became my peer group. And that just shifted. And by 18 years old, I was arrested for first degree intentional homicide, party to the crime, first degree reckless endangering the safety, party to the crime. I was sentenced to life in prison. And for the next 20 years, I fought to prove that I was not guilty of that crime, which I was not. But during that time incarcerated, I met so many men, white, black, Latino, across the racial spectrum, across the class spectrum, that ended up there. And many of these men society had given up on, but these were some of the greatest men and young men I've ever met. But I also got to give a shout out to the volunteers that would march up in there and demand not only that we continue to see our own humanity, but also their mere presence in the system. I mean, in that place, coming in as volunteers from churches, like the church folks were my people, because they would march up in there and show us love in so many different, if we would have a self-help program. They would come and join the churches up there and just be blown away to hear the choir up in there. If you've never heard a prison choir, a man in a prison singing, you listen, you know. And I'd be in the back because I can't hold a note, but they would move my soul. They would help me through so much, and I was going through so much. But in 2014, they sent me to the Supermax prison in Boscobel, Wisconsin. Hell on earth, the very bottom of existence. And I don't have time to go into the details, but within that prison, I met a woman named Pat Anderson. Pat Anderson was at the time a 70-year-old white woman, and she's still white, I'm sure. And she became my homie. She was a teacher, of course, inside a Supermax prison. She did not need to work there, but she believed in the man there. And she took an interest in me. She started a writer's workshop. And at the time, I thought I had wrote the best novel on the planet Earth. And one of my mission was, I'm going to get my novel to her. It was not published. So she started a writer's workshop. I went in there feeling like I'm going to just go through the motions. But ultimately, I'm going to get this book in her hand. She's going to realize how great it is. And she's going to be yelled to the world, let him out, because his words are just so inspiring. And I went through her workshop. And she gave us worksheets and saying, learn what a noun, pronoun, and all these sentence structures is. And I was in there with a sense of arrogance, like, man, I already know this stuff. And I had my first encounter with her red ink, because she had it that and it was humbling. But Pat was at that age, she didn't care, like, what, deal with it. But she and Pat would show up on a tier. She would show up on a tier pushing her cart, and men would be going crazy because of those conditions are maddening. They would be going crazy. So Pat would be walking down the hall and somebody would just come to the door and just get to cussing. And she would stop and say, yes, but do you want a book? And but what she was saying was, despite what you feel right now, I'm going to still see your humanity. And that's what was communicated to me. But Pat, I found out she like marched with Kingdom in the 70s. So I'm like, oh, we got a flower power sister here. She really became... So long story short, I eventually returned to the Green Bay prison, where they sent me from to a Supermax. Pat retired within a year. We got in touch, and she started going to war for my freedom without me even knowing. Pat was like that. She would not tell you what she doing. She would just do it. I was finally able to center this great novel, and it came back splattered in red ink. Like, it was saturated in red ink. But Pat knows what she's talking about. Once my ego went down, we got it in the right form, and she sent it to her friend, Donna Hart, who lives in right here in Middleton. And Donna joined the conspiracy to get me free, and we became like this dynamic duo. Donna is a 60-year-old black woman, but we came together like Voltron and formed this awesome friendship, and to this day we still do things. And this is the shortest version that I can give y'all, but fast forward I went to Baskerville in 2004. I got my case back in court in 2014, 2015, after 20 years, I left out of the prison system. A month later, I went back home to Milwaukee, and same struggle, and I needed a change of environment. A woman named Carolyn Moynihan Brock, who owns 15 acres of beautiful land out in Verona, invited me out there to live, and it was so beautiful during the daytime. Gazebo, swimming pool, just acres of beautiful land. But nighttime, those folks do not like lights out there. So I'm like, I hear coyotes or what, you know? But it was beautiful. And even my first week up here, it was so funny. I was still trying to get my ID and things like that because I had this 20-year gap. And I'm standing in the DMV over there on O'Dana Road, I think. And I'm standing in line, and a white guy come in, and I'm still fresh out, so I'm happy. Like, I'm like, oh, this is. And the white guy come in behind. I said, hey, how you doing? He said, hey. And then I face forward again. Then he said, hey. I said, what's up? He was like, Black Lives Matter. And I'm like, damn, why this is all right. I'm feeling this, you know, like, all right, you know. And I got to tell y'all about Steve, though. Steve, so one day me and Donna was there front and center the whole time during my transition. But one day me and Donna, we were walking in Kohl's right on at Westtown Mall. We were walking in there, and I've been deprived for so many years, I didn't know how to act, so I was shopping, like, you know. And one day I'm coming in Kohl's, and I'm telling, me and Donna walking up there, and I'm telling her, like, man, I gotta get me some new something, I don't know what it was. And it was a sign outside, and she said, yeah, it's time to get a job too, you know what I mean? So I said, okay, you want me to get a job? Let's go get a job. So I walked up in the Kohl's, and she's following me saying, don't start. I said, no, you want me to get a job? I'm gonna get a job. So I walked up to the first Kohl's employee that I saw. I said, hey, do y'all hire convicted felon? And she was a white woman. She like, huh? I said, do y'all hire convicted felon? And Donna like, Rudy, stop it. I said, no, you want me to get a job? Let me get a job. So she like, you gotta ask Steve. So I said, Steve, where's Steve at? She's like, over there. So I go find Steve. Steve is this middle-aged, bald and white guy. And I said, I found Steve, and I said, Steve, do y'all hire convicted felons? Steve was like, huh? I said, do y'all hire convicted felons? She's like, for real? What, you was like, you was in prison? I said, yeah. It's like, what was you locked up for? I said, Steve, I was convicted for a murder. It's like, seriously? I said, yeah. He's like, you know what? I like you. Come on back. So I'm looking at Donna like, and she like, go ahead. You know? So I go in the back, and I'm sitting there talking to Steve. And man, Steve is like, he's like socially aware. He's telling me about Madison and just a lot of the issues that go on up here, and how it's a white liberal town, but sometimes they struggle with that, being white and liberal, when it's time to really give up that privilege. He's talking about young men who are lost, and you know, he's like, he has this social analysis, and I'm like, damn, Steve, you know. And this is coming from a white guy that, like, I'm like, working at Kohl's, it's just something about that. I'm like, you should be in one of the social organizations or something, Steve. But he's laying it down. But he's also giving me my schedule. He like, man, I like you. So he was like, and I'm going to put you on third shift. And we're not going to tell the rest of the employees just yet what you were in jail for. I said, okay, Steve. But at one point, Steve got really quiet. And he said, you know, I did some stuff that I could have easily been in prison like you were for a very long time. And had I not had the resources and the family that I had, I would have been. And it was like an eerie silence in my head. I'm like, Steve, what the hell you done, you know? But I didn't ask it. I had it in my head, and, you know, I'm saying, okay, Steve, but it's time to get on up out this room, you know? So I'm like, hi. He's like, I'm going to get you past corporate. And then, boom, I walked out and found Donna. I'm like, you're not going to believe this. I got a job. And we like celebrating, walking out of Kohl's and whatnot. Steve called 2 days later and said, man, I couldn't get you past corporate. And what happened was Steve saw my humanity. We sat face to face. He felt my spirit. But what corporate saw was on a piece of paper what it said. And it talks directly to the dehumanization of men who come with men and women who come with these stigmas, not understanding really that a human being in prison is just as much of a human being not in prison. So just to acknowledge that, but maybe in 2016 January, I was able to go into the school system. A woman named Denise Hansen, she's this intense woman who would always say, hey, we got to get you in as a volunteer. If we get you in as a volunteer, they got to hire you, Rudy. So me and Denise, we another co-conspirator, we went to work, got me approved as a volunteer, and I was hired at Memorial High School as a restorative practice community liaison for their peace room over there. And one of my jobs was to go out in the community and get volunteers to come in and work with students. And this fit right because I'm about prevention. I support intervention, but I want to get young people when they're at that age where no one can really, it's just too much going on. And it's hard for them to understand themselves what was going on because I was one of those young people. Many young people don't have the resources to really even get the help they need or get the love they need or the support they need, unfortunately. But I do salute the Madison community because I got so many volunteers. They donated things to the Peace Room in the form of books. Fugle Muse donated books and built a bookshelf. And just regular community members who were just great individuals, they contributed, and we got that piece together. Even a brother who is an awesome author, he's doing life in prison right now. He co-wrote a book with my sister at Edgewood. He donated this beautiful painting about peace to the Peace Room. Just awesome. And eventually, I went through the Restore program, and I ended up as a restorative justice coach for the school district. And I've been in that role for the last year, and now I'm doing professional. In that role, I do professional development for everyone from principals to teachers. And it's something about just going into a space, and it's a group of white teachers, and we're talking about white supremacy, and folks are not like, oh my God, he said it. You know what I mean? Because that one thing that we do as a part of restorative justice is the circle process. And the first thing we do, we don't go heavy in circle right away. We build a sense of community amongst each other where we build that trust. So when it's time to take on those tough issues, we don't shy away, and attention is there. But discomfort is the catalyst for growth. And once we get that, get a hold of that really well, then we begin to build. And I'm gonna tell you, it's the adults though who usually fear that, because one of the things I do is also co-teach a social justice class. And our first class was almost pluperfectly diverse. Amongst students, white students, black students, Latino students, Asian students, and we took on some issues in there from watching the documentary 13th, and we getting together and talking about it and how brave these young people were and whatnot. Do I need the Black Panther sound yet? Okay. But just how brave they was. But it's been humbling for me too. One particular circle that we had in the class was, we did sessions on power and oppression, or when name a time you we did a circle round after studying privilege and oppression. And at the end of that, we did a circle round, and around the circle we asked the prompt was, name a time where you've either had privilege or you've been oppressed. So I'm thinking, like, we've been dealing with all this social justice stuff. So right away in my mind, I'm thinking, like, all my little white allies, they're about to say how they have privilege and blah, blah, blah. And then the first, the talking piece came to the first student who was a white female student. And she said, I've been oppressed. And I'm like, okay. I kept a straight face and I'm like, okay. She said, when my my brothers can go anywhere they want to go, but because I'm a girl, I can't. Mm-hmm. Young people teaching the teachers. You know, this is a co-learning space. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, damn, you know? Okay, that's real though. You know what I mean? We gotta humble ourselves in the with young people because they know. You know, so the next, it went to this this Asian student, female. And she's already in tears, like, oh my God, the same thing happened to me. I've been oppressed because the same thing. My brothers can go anywhere they want, but because I'm a girl, I cannot. And then it went, you know, to other people. Then it went to this black girl who's loud as hell in the hallway, but when it gets, she will not participate in circle because that loudness is a defense mechanism. But being vulnerable in circle, she's not trusting what's going, you know, but she listens. And listening is the highest form of participation in circle too. So she passed. You have the right to pass in circle. So she passed, but at the end of the circle, once the circle wrapped up, I sat and watched this black girl go over to this white girl and say, oh my God, the same thing happens to me and my family. Mm-hmm. But the fact that intersectionality of being black and being female, race usually trumps it. And for her, in that moment, they found this commonality that they may have never been able to find had they not been provided the space to talk about those things. And that's the power of restorative justice in education, because you got young people talking about stuff that adults shy away from. And when we're not communicating with each other, not learning each other's story, then people that's in power can always cause this division amongst us. And that those lobsters, they will always appear to back it up. You know, I'm gonna do something with them. I'm gonna send y'all the haiku when I finish it though. But I'm humbled. And just recently, we just started what's called a micro school with 13 La Follette students. And in this space, we're gonna pour our hearts and soul in getting them the things that they need to really be successful. And the first part that we need to do is really deprogram a lot of what they've been made to believe about school. And again, we're not coming through that deficit lens that it's all them. The system fails people. And as simple as that. And it's not a blame or shame game. It's just an acknowledgement that we're all fallible as human beings, and human beings make up every system that's in America. And at the bottom of a lot of those systems are a lot of unjust things driving it. And again, there are good people in every system, but there are also injustices embedded in every system. And I think it's important to stay vigilant for those injustices and stand up for those injustices, and also have compassion, not only self-compassion, but compassion towards every human being that we encounter. Because when we begin to other anyone on any level, a part of our humanity dies with those encounters. So we gotta, and it's hard to love people. Like sometimes, like, you know, we got people that's in power right now. Oh my goodness, you know? But at the end of the day, we hold on to our humanity by, now, don't get me wrong, we still hold each other accountable. I still need to be held accountable. And even though I'm sitting up here talking about these young people and how they've been underserved, if you see me in a room full of them, I'm a warm demander, and sometimes a heated demander, because I expect excellence I set high expectations. But I will sit in a room and I will give it to them in the raw, but then I will turn around and check an adult about them. You know what I mean? If I feel that adult is being unfair to them. So, and also the same way with me. I constantly got to check the inner Trump that's right inside me. I didn't mean to get political. I apologize. This is a Unitarian church, so I feel safe to do that. And if I've offended anybody, you know. But, I think the Batman sign is coming up, or excuse me, the Black Panther sign. Have everyone seen that movie? No? Oh my goodness, I'm on my sixth showing of the movie. I'm convinced that my ancestors are talking to me through that movie, but it's just, it's deep, it's beautiful, and it's wonderful. It's for youth of color to be able to see themselves reflected in something that has never been in America. Like, just, and even though it's a fictional film, just allowing them to have the imagination, to allow their imagination to taste something like that, and it's powerful, and it is a really good movie. I've heard Cherokee a couple weeks ago. I was at a meeting at Cherokee with the principal, and she casually said, "We're gonna take the seventh graders to see Black Panther right away." I said, "Y'all need an extra adult to go?" And at the time, I was on my third, but I rolled up in there right over on Mineral Point. We got this new school with these boys. I'm already planning a field trip to go see it, but it's rich in curriculum and just identity work and things like that. So we're going to rock it out. And no, they did not pay me to promote that movie. Yeah, it's amazing. And it's amazing, you know. And people want to see the world differently. If we allow them the opportunity, that stuff stimulates our imagination. You know, it used to be films about flying saucers before a plane. You know what I mean? And just allowing stuff to come in. But if we close our minds to that stuff, we'd never know what the world. Imagine the first person that said, "Hey, I'm going to make an object fly and levitate." And how many people said, "Dude, really?" You know what I mean? But now we got jets and planes and drones and all kind of special stuff. So,
Questions?
Absolutely. Like, I'm telling you, young people are brave. Like, and the beauty of the circle is, it's not, even though I would facilitate, I say we're co-leaders in this, but like, awesome. I like, they show up and like show out, you know, and they're not coming as empty slates. We're learning from each other. You know what I mean? But go over there. I invite you to go over there and listen to some of these students and how politically aware they are. But young people are driving the movement, so I'm ready to get out their way and let them, hey, tear it up, turn it around. This is why I love young people. All we got to do is give them the platform and get out their way, give them the wisdom.
You should hear him.
No doubt. I don't doubt it. I hear him in Memorial, you know what I mean? So professional development, most teachers, quite frankly, can't stand the professional development because they think it's a waste of their time. They could be planning and whatnot. And if professional development isn't quality, like anything, we're going to be like, oh my gosh, you know. But we're supposed to be carrying out what the vision is for the school district. This year, it's on culturally responsive and linguistic subject matter. It's on quote unquote equity. We got this thing in the district saying, yeah, they doing equity with a small E. We support anything that helps with the professional development of teachers. Unfortunately, some of it is bland, you know what I mean? But some of it is really good. And I've been involved and teamed with, I recently teamed with curriculum and instruction and in the district. I just walk downstairs. I claim agency. They're going to eventually, you know. But I walk downstairs like, hey, let's combine this work. And we got the survey at the end, and the teachers, it was English language art teachers, 6th, 7th, and 8th. We did 3 days, one group of teacher each day, schools all over the district. And they ended the survey. This is what this work is about right here. This is what a professional development should be. Because it wasn't us all professional, because restorative justice is heart work. Restorative justice is sharing our stories, and we all have stories. And putting that heart work in there and getting away from so much all headiness, because people want to connect through the heart as well. So that was kind of a revolutionary thing for the school district. And great question, thank you. But I know about food deserts and how to starve people out that you don't want there. It's not right, and we fight. We organize, you know, and we act. I'm familiar with rites of passage during my imprisonment. I studied a lot of the African traditions, including what Europeans dubbed as the mystery system, because they didn't know what these universities were in Africa that these black people erected. And one of the things about the rites of passage is they understood knowledge and how knowledge in the wrong hands, how dangerous that was. So you had to go through a rites of passage to test your character and things like that. And if you don't go through that rites of passage and prove yourself to be a man of integrity or whatnot, then they don't give you access to that knowledge. And I think bringing it more to a more present version, I think it's still important, but I think we as adults need to learn how to live more authentically and model that for young people. And I think that's the first step, because again, professional, we smile, but we're not smiling. Our hearts isn't smiling. And it's okay to be professional, but also find our authentic core and live from there as much as possible. Because I think the jig is up. I think the jig is up, and these young people are saying, y'all politicize everything, and we want peace. So we're going to get in, we're going to cause some chaos in order to do it. I would abolish prisons. We need mental health facilities. We need humanity centers, like where you treat men and women. You have, for those who, it's a Michael Moore film, Who Do We Bomb Next? And he talks about prisons over in, I think, Norway, and how they treat their those who are held in captivity with such humanity. The problem in America is follow the money, and it's an incentive for when Donald Trump. Here I go again. But when Donald Trump was on his platform talking about immigration and things and building walls and locking up immigrants and whatnot, so-called immigrants, they're our family too. The day he got elected, private prisons stocks went up 400%, because corporate America knew we got our man up in there. Now he finna start rounding up Mexicans. You know what I mean? So when we talk about the prison system, we cannot separate it from following the money. And once you follow money, then and it's not just to find out and boohoo about it. It's if we're going to change something, we need to understand it, and we need to look at it in a very candid way. But follow the money. When they opened up the Boscobel prison in 1999, I was in the Green Bay prison, and I'm sitting on my cell reading an article about this new Supermax prison that was built in Boscobel, and how they had like a carnival on the grounds of the prison, and they had a ribbon cutting ceremony because the prison was bringing jobs to their community, with no thoughts about the men who would be housed in. But that's the whole thing. And then I could see Tommy Thompson would never admit this, but one day his brother, because they were building another prison in the community, and his brother was running for office before, and one day they interviewer was talking to him because they were talking about building this new prison, and people in the community is like, we don't want a prison in our backyard and blah blah blah. And Tommy Thompson said, Tommy Thompson's brother said, it's going to bring jobs to the community. And it got quiet as hell on that. Like, it was like, okay. Like, you didn't hear much debate afterwards, because with outsources and technology and things like that, a lot of jobs left these communities. And then someone came up with an idea, wait, let's build prisons and make tougher laws to lock more people up. And boom, you know what I mean? Because you can't outsource prisons. You know, you can send them in prison, so-called inmates, to other states in private prisons to save, but you can't outsource them. So that's this like one of America's last standing industries. Thank you.
At this time, I ask Kagi Hughes to come up for our closing words.
May we never rest until every child of earth in every generation is free from all prisons of the mind and of the body and of the spirit.
until the earth and the hills and the seas shall dance and the universe itself resound with the joyful cry, "Behold, I am."
Thank you for coming. Please extend your hand of friendship to your neighbors and those around you, and join us for coffee and conversations.